Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, to the meeting over to Dave Daigle. You may begin.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Daigle with CDC Media Relations. This morning, we want to provide a brief update on today's call, and we have with us Dr. Anne Schuchat. She is the director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, and Dr. Joe Breezy, who is the branch chief for the epidemiology branch in our influenza division. Dr. Schuchat will have a short opening statement, and then we'll turn it over for questions. Thanks.
Well, good morning, and thanks for calling in for this briefing. I'd like to be pretty brief here and just give you a snapshot of the latest statistics, the trends that we're seeing, and really spend most of the time on your questions. You know, as we've been saying, we had expected more cases, and we are continuing to find them. Today, there are almost 3,000 probable and confirmed cases here in the United States in 45 states and the District of Columbia. That's an increase of 494 since yesterday. The breakdown is 2,254 confirmed cases and 722 probable cases, and of course the details are on our website. There are 104 hospitalized cases, and we still, for information about that, we are still seeing quite a few of the hospitalized cases having underlying diseases. Our assessment is that transmission here in the U.S. is ongoing, that this is a very easily transmissible virus, similar to the seasonal influenza viruses. And we've been suggesting that it's less important to focus on these individual numbers in states or the totals, and instead to look really at the trend. I want to let you know that our regular flu website is at www.cdc.gov. We have a seasonal influenza website that uses our routine influenza systems. That's been updated again yesterday. We updated it weekly. And there you can see that the impact of this particular virus spreading around the country is visible in our influenza-like illness ILI net graph. You can see an increase in the proportion of doctor visits that are for influenza-like illness in this past week that we're reporting. You also can look at there on a map, the FluView map, that shows state-by-state activity. It's really an aggregate of all influenza activity, seasonal and this new H1N1. But the trends from this particular new virus are showing up in that ILI illness graphic. We're going forward going to continue to report to you the case counts as we get them, but we'll also be reporting those routine systems data, and I think that can help put this in context. You know, the virus is continuing to spread here. Fortunately, the severity of illness that we're seeing at this point doesn't look as terrible as a Category 5 kind of pandemic or the really devastating impact that some had feared. But as you know, influenza virus is unpredictable. It can change over time. And going forward, it's really important to us that we pay attention to how this virus may or may not change as it circulates here in the U.S. and around the world, what happens in the Southern Hemisphere, where they're just heading into their flu season now, and really anticipating what might happen in the fall. So a lot of our emphasis here in the U.S. is still understanding the epidemiology, transmission, severity, and viral characteristics, but also working with partners internationally to really prepare and evaluate issues in their countries. There are activities going forward across government in thinking through the issues involved with vaccine development. As we've said, we're preparing the vaccine candidate strain to hand off to researchers and industry, and the government will be exploring additional efforts going forward related to vaccine. But at this point, we're trying to make sure that there continues to be the appropriate level of concern for this kind of circumstance where a totally new virus has entered the human population. We've heard in the media and from partners the sense that the all-clear whistle has gone off or we're out of the woods, but I do want you to know that here at CDC and in the public health community, active efforts are still ongoing. At this point, I'd like to open the call to questions that you have.
Thank you. Yes, operator, our first question, please.
First question comes from Daniel DeNoon, WebMD. Your line is open.
Thank you, Dr. Shuckett. Do you have any sense of whether the flu levels from the new flu are above the epidemic level? What are you seeing at this level? And my second question is, are you getting any results back from serology testing? Any sense of how infectious this is and what kind of spread you're seeing from this virus? Thank you.
Thank you. One of the ways with seasonal influenza, we compare the information against an epidemic threshold. And one of the markers for that is our pneumonia and influenza mortality that comes from 122 cities. And good news is we are not seeing a rise above the epidemic threshold in that system. That would be a very worrisome sign, especially at this time of year, and we're not seeing that. So the influenza-like illness is increasing above the threshold that we would expect for this point in time. We know that more people are going to the doctors. We believe more people were seeking health care a week or so ago based on concern about this, and a higher percentage of doctor visits were for influenza-like illness. We're collecting viral specimens in that context to understand whether it's seasonal flu or other respiratory viruses or this new H1N1 virus. And in our virologic surveillance, we actually see a mixture. There's more testing going on. The seasonal flu strains are still circulating, but there's also this new virus that's circulating. So those graphics are all on our website for the flu aficionados who are on the call. Under the FluView site, you can sort of see that we are starting to be able to detect this issue in our weekly reports, some of which are now daily, but a lot of the most worrisome feature, the mortality one, we haven't seen an increase in that.
Thank you, Daniel. Okay. Next question, please.
Next question, Mike Stobie with Associated Press. Your line is open.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. An update on how many states have the kits and are doing confirmatory testing. And also, could you tell me, Dr. Besser had mentioned before, we might be seeing some data from CDC on ER visits and doctor visits, some quantifying of that volume. Do you have any information on that?
Right. All of the states have received the kits, and what is happening is more and more of them are validating their testing. They're getting their testing validated to be able to catch up with, to do their own testing. We also have certain reference states helping others in terms of the validation. So I don't believe I actually have the number of states. I'm looking through my materials here. I don't think I actually have the numbers today of how many states are doing their own testing, but I would say it's going to be increasing on a regular basis. We had been really paying a lot of attention to that backlog in the states and here to try to make sure that we could catch up. But again, I want to say we want to transition into this period where the seasonal flu types of systems are more helpful. You had another question about the doctor visits. Could you just repeat that again? I lost track of what the question was.
The volume of ER visits was going up, at least for a while. Dr. Besser at one point said, if I understood him correctly, CDC might have some numbers or some quantifying of that. I was wondering if you had numbers that could let us know for this swine flu, how many people have been going to the ER and or going to the doctor.
Right. So the ER numbers I don't have. There's a system that does try to track that in a few places. It won't be numbers, but it'll be above baseline, and there's a certain percentage of the ERs where we have data that we're seeing an increase in visits for influenza-like illness. The information that you'll be able to see on the website, though, shows the doctor visit part of that more people were going to the doctors for influenza-like illness, and that definitely shows up in our national statistics. We are above the national baseline for this time of year on a national level. well above it. You can sort of see everything was going down, and then it starts to come up. But when we look at the virologic characteristics of what is being tested in these kinds of systems, we see that it is not all this new strain. The new strain accounts for a portion of the cases, but a similar portion of the cases are the regular seasonal influenza strains, the regular H1N1, the regular H3N2, and the regular influenza B strains. So that we don't see we're not at a point right now where 100% of the virologic isolates that are tested are this new strain. That may be viewed as good news that this strain hasn't totally dominated, or you could say it's bad news because the circulating viruses for seasonal flu are still there, and that gives us a risk for reassortment. So I would say it's an interesting observation and one that we're taking seriously and continuing to follow.
Thanks, Michael. Next question, please, operator.
Next question, Emma Head with Medscape. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you very much for giving this press conference. What advice do you have for clinicians about the use of antivirals? And are you concerned or do you have any evidence that there's a development of resistance to these agents?
You know, those are great questions. We have been updating guidance for clinicians, and our website will have the most recent interim guidance. Early on in this situation with a totally unknown new virus, we were fairly aggressive in our treatment recommendations. As we've seen more and more infections and understood the characteristics of illness, we've tried to update the guidance to focus on making sure that severe illness gets treated with antiviral drugs, that people who have underlying risk factors for complications of influenza, such as pregnant women or people with long-term medical problems, that those patients really can benefit from treatment, but that other people probably can get away with self-care at home. And so we're really trying to make sure that the antiviral therapy is available for the severest cases or those in a higher risk group. You know, the good news so far is that the vast majority of people seem to have a self-limited illness, you know, a few days at home in bed and then a few days more at home staying away from other people so that you don't spread the virus when you go back to work or school. The resistance question is also important. You know, very good news right now that the viruses we've characterized are not resistant to oseltamivir and zanamivir, you know, Tamiflu and Relenza. But we have seen changes in resistance very quickly for seasonal flu viruses, and this is one of our big concerns. We really want to make sure that we're tracking resistance because things could change rapidly. So that's another reason that the focus of our antiviral drug recommendations right now is on treatment, not prevention, and on treatment in the people who we think may suffer the worst consequences from the flu.
Thanks, Emma. Next question, please, operator.
Again, as a reminder, star one to ask a question. Our next question comes from Marilyn Chase with Bloomberg News. Your line is open.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my question. I have sort of a two-part question, if I may, both having to do with vaccines and with immunology. First of all, I understand from talking with Dr. Fauci that he has sent you sera from people who were vaccinated against the 1976 swine flu to see if those blood samples retained any cross-reactivity to the H1N1 we're now seeing. And do you have any insight into whether since the earlier sporadic cases outlined in the New England Journal this past week, which seemed to prompt more severe disease, whether in gaining human-to-human transmissibility, do your virologists find that there's been any loss of lethality genes or virulence genes?
A couple comments. The serologic, the serum from the 1976 vaccine recipients is being worked on in our laboratories. The immunologic assays that have been carried out so far are very complex, and we're at early stages of putting the data together, you know, and trying to amass sufficient numbers of results in different population groups to be able to interpret the results. And so I would say it would be premature for me to summarize what we know right now, because I think we're not finished with those evaluations. I think there was another part of, you asked about the virulence markers, and yes, this issue of how do influenza viruses change as they go through populations, they may, in order to be fit in sustaining transmission, they may change some of their properties in terms of mutations and evolving characteristics. What we know so far is that a number of viral isolates have been sequenced, and the sequence information has been looked at carefully by us and by many other researchers. That information is in the public domain, so that the whole scientific research community, which is the phenomenal engine for this kind of issue, is really attending to that. And the good news so far is that the virulence markers that have been characterized for the 1918 strain and for the H5N1 strain do not appear in the viruses we're seeing with this H1N1 problem. That's good news, because we know those virulence markers are bad news. But what we don't know is whether there are other virulence markers, either for 1918 or H5N1, whether there may be characteristics of this virus that are potential to be more virulent. From what we're seeing epidemiologically, the pattern doesn't look like the 1918 strain, but remember that in 1918, the first wave was fairly mild, and it was the next wave which was so devastating. So I think that we can, the absence of those markers is reassuring, but not so reassuring that we're not continuing to study, and we are definitely taking this very seriously.
Thanks, Marilyn. Next question, please, operator.
Next question, Maggie Fox with Reuters. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm wondering how much of all the attention that we're paying to this is an artifact of just being able to genetically test this virus. If this had happened 20 years ago, would we have just been talking about kind of an unusually late flu and, interesting, and not much more attention to it than that?
That's a really interesting question. We have invested substantially in strengthening our surveillance, strengthening our laboratory capacity, and strengthening our global partnership, so that when increases in pneumonia in Mexico occur, the global community can know about them and try to contribute, or so that when unusual viruses emerge, we detect them early. We know that there have been bad problems in the past when emerging infections smoldered. Think back on what would have happened had we recognized HIV much, much earlier and been able to respond. So I think that the question of whether we are ahead of things because of those investments and responding to a new virus more aggressively than we might have 15 years ago, I do think we know about this problem earlier than we might have. But that's really the value of the investment in preparedness, that had we known, if we end up having a bad pandemic of influenza from this strain, we will have had a real jump start on issues like vaccine development and production and prevention and preparedness. So I think that there's this trade-off of a signal that you respond to versus responding to everything. This particular virus had all of the hallmarks that we look for with a possible pandemic: a totally new virus, capable of causing disease in people, capable of causing disease that's serious in terms of death, and easy ease of transmission. So all of those characteristics are the ones that you look for in a possibly pandemic-causing strain, and I think that's really why we've been reacting. Might we have never even realized we had a problem? I'm not sure. We're certainly, mindful that there's a balance.
Thanks very much, Maggie. Next question, please.
Next question is from Deb Krasnick with CNN. Your line is open. Deb Krasnick, your line is open.
Sorry, I forgot to hit mute back. We got an email saying that Vermont has just confirmed a new case. Do you know if that's Vermont's second case, or if that's been confirmed by the CDC or anything about that?
No, I don't have that information, but I'd encourage you to contact the Vermont Health Department. The other thing is that our website, as of 11 a.m. every day, lists the confirmed cases by state, so that will show you, you know, how many in Vermont are confirmed as of 11 a.m. today. I'm not it's one. Okay, so as of 11 a.m. today, our website is showing one case confirmed in Vermont. So, but I think, as you know, we're only updating that once a day because these there's testing going on in the states as well as here. Things are very fluid, and again, the individual numbers we think are less vital than the trends. You know, I think an important point to say is that we think that this virus is in most of the United States, and its arrival is a wake-up to evaluate what's going on, but that the individual numbers are likely a very great underestimate of how much virus is circulating or how many people are becoming ill from this. We do now trying to focus on the severe illness that's occurring that may be attributed to this virus and the trend. So I know that it's in every state it's really easy to focus on the numbers, but I think right now the numbers don't tell us as much as the trend.
Thank you. Next question, please, operator.
Next question, James Unwin, with editor of Health, Business, and Policy. Your line is open.
Thank you very much for taking my question. My question goes to something that came out in an interview with Dr. Carolyn Bridges the other day. She really indicated that the time lapse between an outbreak of some kind and confirmation is crucial, trying to narrow that time lapse. Is CDC or the U.S. government considering giving countries like Mexico more full-scale labs so we can shorten and narrow that time lag, so to speak? Because it seems like during that time lag, people are highly contagious but non-symptomatic, and each day that goes by is crucial. Thank you for taking my question.
You know, our international strategy has been vital to our pandemic preparedness effort. The CDC has been working with the World Health Organization and a number of ministries of health around the world to strengthen their pandemic preparedness, and in some of the world to strengthen their efforts at being ready for avian influenza. This pandemic preparedness efforts involve investments in laboratory capacity, investments in epidemiologic capacity, rapid response teams to be able to respond to clusters of unusual illness. And we think those are really vitally important in shortening the time between when a problem happens and when it's investigated and responded to. So that the laboratory capacity for influenza is just central to the recognition of a new virus, and it is a big part of our investment. As we've said on previous calls, one of the issues that has been part of our partnership with Mexico has been strengthening their laboratory capacity for this particular new virus so that they'd be able to detect this strain in the background of all the other respiratory viruses that are out there. We have done, in the context of this response, of course, we've shipped the new reagents, the test kits to dozens of countries around the world, and we've made this a part of the WHO partnership, really. So I think your question is spot on, because whether it's this H1N1 virus or something else, having strong laboratory capacity around the world is very important.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Next question, Delphia Ricks with Newsday. Your line is open.
Thank you for taking my question. I'd like to know if you can give us a sense of what the level of concern is now that this virus is in circulation, along with, in some parts of the world, the endemic prevalence of H5N1.
You know, this is a very unusual circumstance we have right now, to have a new H1N1 strain that's very easily transmittable, that is spreading in our continent and has arrived in many others, and then to have parts of the world where the animal outbreak or enzootic of H5N1 is occurring. We know the H5N1 strain can be very virulent although right now it has not become efficiently transmitted human to human. One of the big challenges with influenza viruses is the way that they change, the way that they combine, and their prevalence in a number of different species. So we do think this is an unusual and difficult circumstance to have circulation of this new H1N1, the regular seasonal flu viruses, and then in certain countries, the H5N1. This is why it's so important for countries to have strong capacities to deal with influenza, and also why it's very important to focus on what happens at the interface between people and animals. And these are areas of attention that we're investing resources into with a lot of other partners.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Next question, Andy Pollack with New York Times. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. Pardon me, I haven't been paying that much attention over the last couple of weeks to the epidemiology, but is there any sense that the number of new cases is leveling off, diminishing, or is it kind of accelerating?
Yes.
And I was also wondering if you might explain this concept someone asked about before of the epidemic threshold. I know we're not at it, but what exactly defines the epidemic threshold?
Great. Okay. The I think some of you have seen the what we call epidemic curve, cases by day of onset or cases by day of report. Our MMWRs this past week showed epidemic curves for the U.S. and Mexico, and I think the New England Journal article earlier this week also showed an epidemic curve for the U.S. It's important to say that those curves do not incorporate a lag time, that additional cases may be happening and are not yet showing on the curve. So we think that the trends that you see, you know, a big peak and then a decline, are not an accurate assessment of the ongoing occurrence of disease. We do think here in the U.S. it's possible that increased cases are occurring, and it's too soon for us to say whether in some communities things are getting better. Our indicators suggest that we're still accelerating. We're still seeing an increase in cases. The issue in Mexico, there's a little bit more data to suggest they may be, in some parts of the country, seeing a decline, in other parts perhaps not yet. But so I would say that we don't think there's a drop in occurrence of this illness here in the U.S., and that's why we're trying to use some of our routine seasonal flu systems to see which way things are going. The epidemic threshold, that's an issue where we look year and year, you know, many years in a row, we average how much disease should you have on a particular week compared with historical baselines. And there's a range that is within what we usually see. And when we talk about an epidemic threshold with seasonal influenza, it means we've gone outside those bounds. This can happen in a regular flu season. It's a way where we can estimate week to week, you know, this looks like a little bit worse regular flu season than what we've had in the past 5 or 10 years. It doesn't really relate to the pandemic concept. It's a term we use for understanding seasonal flu. If you look back at the 2003-04 season, we think of that as a pretty severe season. That one exceeded the epidemic threshold during many weeks of the season.
So I think that was our last question, and I want to remind everybody, we're not planning a briefing for Sunday. Our next scheduled or planned briefing will be Monday, and we'll announce that time or send out a media advisory Monday morning. We want to thank everybody for joining us today and wish everybody a happy Mother's Day.
This concludes today's conference. We thank you for your participation. At this time, you may disconnect your lines.